Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Get notebook, paper, and a pen for later in the show, and as always, we first start by looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. United Bank, Florida's biggest regional bank, tripled its profit in 2006 by aggressively selling a popular type of high-interest loan to risky borrowers. It has lost nearly $100 million in late 2007 and early 2008 as the real estate market has cratered, the New York Times reported. Bank United CEO Alfred Kamner is now scrambling to raise $400 million in capital, an amount nearly eight times the bank's shriveled value on the stock market. Analysts and a corporate governance group are monitoring the bank's asset quality and asking why Kramner was allowed, with board approval, to amass a pool of volatile loans that at one point represented 75% of the bank's mortgage portfolio. In further news, the Federal Open Market Committee decided to keep its target for the federal fund rate at 2%. According to the Fed, economic activity expanded in the second quarter, partly reflecting growth in consumer spending and exports. However, labor markets have softened further and financial markets remain under considerable stress. The tight credit conditions, the ongoing housing contraction, and elevated energy prices are likely to weigh on economic growth over the next few quarters, according to the Fed. Over time, the substantial easing of monetary policy, combined with ongoing measures to foster market liquidity, should help to promote moderate economic growth. Inflation has been high, spurred by the earlier increases in the prices of energy and some other commodities, and some indicators of inflation expectations have been elevated. The committee expects inflation to moderate later this year and next year, but the inflation outlook remains highly uncertain. Although downside risks to growth remain, the upside risks to inflation are also of significant concern to the committee. The committee will continue to monitor economic and financial developments and will act as needed to promote sustainable economic growth and price stability. And of course, that was all according to the Fed. Next, I'd like to read from an article by O. Max Gardner III, one of the leading and most creative and successful bankruptcy attorneys in America out of Shelby, North Carolina. He says, and I quote, "Our field of vision these days seems to be limited by a focus on the incidental, the trivial, and the margins of economy in serious peril. The truth is that the United States is on the cusp of the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression. This so-called limited vision is demonstrated by the Washington talking points that seek to explain the current problems in simplistic terms that focus the blame on consumers. For instance, Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke are fond of saying that the current mortgage mess is the result of too many consumers borrowing too much money, buying too many homes that they could not afford, and signing loan documents that overstated their income or assets." Max continues, "Certainly consumers played a role in our present economic debacle. However, little attention has been paid to the global financial profiteers who willfully and intentionally ignored the risks of their own financial models by force-feeding, quote, no income, no asset verification mortgage loans to everyone who had a verifiable pulse. We must not forget that the smartest guys in the room at Bear Stearns were knee-deep in these loans and were focused on the short-term profits instead of the long-term health of the American economy." Those blaming consumers for their own self-inflicted injuries are ignoring the demise of a culture based on thrift. Visa tells us to live richly, and we are told that having a MasterCard is priceless. If you are anybody, you cannot leave your home without your American Express card. We have even coined a new slogan for the consumption economy. When the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. During the last 5 years, rising home prices, based in part on made-to-made order appraisals, gave people the impression that they could safely take on more and more debt. America entered a period of mass luxury, in which people further down the economic ladder expected to own homes, purchase designer goods, and buy new cars and trucks. The perplexing thing about the current reckoning is why we are treating this problem any differently than the problem with illegal drugs, according to Max Gardner. During the so-called war on drugs, we did not target the users. Rather, we pursued the producers and the distributors. The producers and distributors of our financial problems are not the consumers, but rather the Wall Street investment bankers and their foreign and not-so-foreign investors. The new partnership of global capital and bizarre new investment bonds is the source of the problem. Consequently, the story of our financial demise begins with this global pool of money and tragically ends with lost homes, lost lives, and lost dreams. Yes, the American dream has turned into a uniquely American nightmare for hundreds of thousands of our citizens. If you take all of the money spent by the entire world's population in 2006, it adds up to less than the global pool of money that was available that year for investment. In 2000, this annual investment pool was approximately $36 trillion. By 2006, it had grown to almost $80 trillion. The doubling of the global money supply created the need to find more sources of investment. By holding the federal funds rate to 1% for an extended period of time, Alan Greenspan signaled to global investors that U.S. Treasury bonds would not produce much of a return. Looking for higher returns, the global money funds turned to investment-grade bonds backed by high-interest subprime adjustable-rate mortgages and the so-called Alt-A arms. This, in a nutshell, is how global investors moved from investing in treasury bills to investing in mortgage-backed bonds and collateral debt obligations. Veteran journalist and author William Grider, writing on usurious subprime debt, recently said in The Nation that we are witnessing a momentous event, the great deflation of Wall Street, and it is far from over. The crash of IndyMac Bank is just the beginning. More banks will fail, so will many more debtors. The crisis has the potential to transform American politics because, first, it destroys a generation of ideological bromides about free markets, and second, because it makes visible the ugly power realities of our deformed democracy. For those of you just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and I am reading from an article by O. Max Gardner, one of the leading debt and bankruptcy specialists in America, talking about our economy's current state of affairs. He continues, "Our democracy has been deformed because the regulation of large financial institutions and the protection of consumers have not been popular political issues. The Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 is the best example of this political mindset. Democrats and Republicans have been bipartisan in their collusion during the past 30 years by creating the unregulated financial systems and mammoth mega banks that produced the phony valuations and deceitful assurances that everything will be all right. The federal government has built a system that protects the most powerful interests from the consequences of their own plundering. Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac are only the most recent beneficiaries of the system. These institutions are too big to fail, but the average American is small enough to drop in the gutter on the side of the road. What is market justice for some is not market justice for all." Appearing recently on Bill Moyer's Journal, to comment on the show's investigation of the plundering of Cleveland's real estate by predatory lenders, Grider said, quote, usury, to be clear about it, is rich people taking advantage of poor people by lending them money on terms that are sure to make them fail. All three of the great religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, had a moral prohibition against usury because they recognized that society can't function like that. People of great wealth and their institutions, like banks, naturally have the power to overwhelm people of lesser means. And you can't allow that in a decent society. It won't survive. End quote. And Will Grider, of course, is right. Jesus Christ threw all of the money lenders out of the temple, not because they were loaning money, but because they were charging interest on the money they were loaning. The mortgage crisis in Cleveland is described in a report drafted by Cuyahoga County Treasurer Jim Rokakis as follows. Back in the old days, when there was no sheriff in town, people would rob the banks. Well, here we are in modern day era, and there's no sheriff in town. The banks were robbing the people. The victims of the total lack of qualifications for borrowing were not only the borrowers, but according to Rokakis, the people who live on the block, who pay their taxes, who play by the rules, and who have done nothing to deserve what they are facing today. Devastated neighborhoods and home values. The observations of Jim Rokakis exemplify what all this subprime lending leads to: the decimation of working-class neighborhoods in every American city, town, and suburb. During a recent congressional hearing on the proposed $300 billion bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, Senator Jim Bunning asked Secretary Paulson, "Whose money is that?" Paulson answered, "Obviously, it would come from the government." When Bunning snapped back, "And who is the government?" Practically mumbling, Paulson said, "The taxpayers." Yes, it is coming from us. Perhaps the very least that can be done, as William Grider proposed, is to nationalize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, holders of more than half of the $12 trillion in U.S. housing debt. By making them federal agencies, as Fannie Mae was when created in the Depression by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, we can reinstate oversight and restore protections against usury, predatory lending, and predatory mortgage servicing. As Moyer points out in his introduction, California's big IndyMac bank went down with the crash, the second worst collapse in U.S. history, and sent thousands of depositors out looking for their money. The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, took over as reports circulated that the FBI is investigating IndyMac for mortgage fraud. Analysts are predicting that as many as 150 of the 7,500 banks in America may fail over the next 18 months, and one analyst even said that number might double over the next 3 years. Amidst this, President Bush is still upbeat about the economy and says it is all going to come out okay. He seems to have no idea that he's standing on the deck of the Titanic and the iceberg is waiting in the dark between today and tomorrow. In the face of this disaster, one of the great proposals from William Grider is, quote, restore the federal law against usury. That won't have too many details to it at first, but it'll be a general statement that the federal government is prohibiting the kind of outrageous predatory practices which have become general in this country of not just banks, but other financial firms. I'm not sure this will work, but I am sure that many Americans are mad and they are not going to take this much longer. Time is short and somebody needs to act and act quickly. We need more than change. We need a major transformation. And this was all from an article by O. Max Gardner, as I said, one of the leading scholars and activists and bankruptcy lawyers in America out of Shelby, North Carolina. So now I'd like to jump into taking control of your situation in spite of this backdrop that we've been talking about, and by helping yourself to create for yourself some balance in your life and some control of your finances. We've been working on the comfortable stage of having debt, and at the onset, I want to again credit the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are somewhat based on the works, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading debt relief champions. And I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. We always start with a recap of the new points from last week. You can always also go to the archives at www.liptaclaw.com/life-and-debt to listen to all the previous shows. We've been looking at the want category of our equation, and that had two basic principles that we were considering: having a clear limit for your want category in terms of how much money you can realistically spend in the want category. And as I said in the past, not so much on what you spend that money — this is your have fun category — but how much there is available to spend. And we took a self-test in how well we set our limits, and we asked some questions on a true and false questionnaire, and I will again go over that questionnaire, and all the responses are either true or false. One, I can't resist buying certain things. I charge things on several different credit cards. It's hard to keep track of how much is in the bank. When I go out, I usually end up spending more than I planned. When my credit card bill arrives, I am always shocked by how big it is. I can never make it through the holiday without spending a lot of money. Sometimes I buy things, but when I get them home, I think, I really can't afford this. I don't really want to add up how much I spend. I think I'd rather not know. I usually buy what I want, even if I'm not sure I can afford it. So those were true and false type questions. And as I said, if you responded to two or more statements with true, you would benefit from putting some tighter control on your fund spending, this want category. If you marked true for more than four statements, or should I say four statements or more, this should serve really as a very loud wake-up call that you are spending money in a binging style and it is undermining your financial health, which really means your happiness. And the second point we discussed is shifting to cash, and really that this was the key to confidence. When we use credit cards, we are never clear on what we are spending, and of course that's not just upfront money for the purchase, but on the interest and fees and all of that that are associated. And it's very easy to put down plastic, and the money that we have spent mounts. We don't see it until we get the credit card statement, and then we're shocked at the bottom line. We vaguely remember the purchases that we made that are listed there, and then how it actually translates into what we are owing is extraordinarily confusing, even for attorneys who have gone through these things. They're quite difficult to comprehend the legal ramifications, if not the calculations themselves, that the credit card statement is generating. So for the wants category, keeping track of your total spending is important. Money is money, but it does matter how you pay. So the credit card is definitely on the blacklist. We shouldn't be paying with credit cards because they make overspending very, very easy. And then, of course, when we get that credit card statement, our life becomes very stressful and it is exceedingly complicated because the credit card spending is invisible while we're doing it and incomprehensible once we receive the statement. In short, credit cards are ridiculously and unbelievably expensive, with annual fees, late fees, interest charges, spending your own money. This is what you're paying for. It's like throwing money in the garbage can if you look at what is happening here. And as I mentioned, even people who are paying off their balances every month, there are ways that the credit card company is making money off of them. And the whole system is set up to make you flounder, fail, make a mistake. And ultimately, that puts you in the spiral because those mistakes are very hard to remedy, and then you are in their trap. And that's what they're looking for, to be quite frank and blunt about it. For those of you just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And speaking of credit cards, one thing you have to understand is that these companies are making really frighteningly outrageous amounts of money. It is almost incomprehensible how much money they're making from late fees and interest, etc. And of course, they want you to sign up. They have a lot of gifts and gimmicks and lures and credit card freebies that are there from the beginning, or even once you have your credit card, to get you to not just sign up, then to spend and spend and spend. And this is basically a con job on their part, trying to get you to cough up your hard-earned cash. They hire professionals to seduce you to getting and using the card. These are people that are on their staffs that are full-time salaried employees just to get you to spend. If you look closely at what it is that you're being given in terms of gifts and gimmicks and lures, frankly, they're usually of very little financial value. But even if they are, in some cases they seem to be, they are there as an inducement because, in fact, the credit card company is making huge profits off all of its users. Note that credit card company profits are increasing every year by really quantum jumps. 2 years ago, $110 billion, and last year, 2007, it went from $110 billion to $117 billion were earned by the credit card companies, which is why their CEOs are making in excess of $10 million, and in some cases, in excess of $100 million a year. So our thinking, which really should now become your thinking, is a goal. Do not send your hard-earned cash to the credit card company ever. If you can really somehow, with intelligence and might of will, just decide to stop using credit cards, it would be one of the best steps you ever took in your financial life in terms of its health. A curious and interesting point is that research studies and statistics have shown that when you use a credit card, you will actually spend more money up front than if you use cash. You will be paying a lot more for the item in the short and the long run just by using the credit card. So it's not a wise step to take. So we say use cash. Now, a reflective value of both credit cards and cash is kind of a hybrid, is the debit card. The debit card can be used wisely if it is the right kind of debit card and we use it carefully. It has some of the same characteristics of credit cards because when you use it, you don't have an immediate reaction as to how much you have been spending, because as you look in your wallet, it's not an issue of how much money is left over there. You have to do mental gymnastics by knowing what's in your bank account. So what I recommend is that in your care, you use your debit card only in conjunction with an online account, something that you look at every day so you can get your statement there on a daily basis. You could also check to see if there's any problems that have arisen from the debit card and with your bank. If you don't do this, then it is more like a credit card because you don't know what you have as when you open your wallet and see the cash is there or is not there. And I have a good example, a personal example. My 18-year-old son, we got him a debit card. One of the important things is that it's with a bank that does not treat it like a credit card with fees. There's no fees attached. Just locally here at Iowa State Bank, there's no fees with the debit card. But my son, we open up this debit card for him, and it's very good. He can use it in an appropriate way, but I also force him to go online, which I did at first, and then afterwards he was wanting to go online because, in fact, he saw his hard-earned cash being spent, and he has a record there immediately, and he knows that it is going down. If he doesn't use that debit card appropriately. So there is some more immediate feedback loop, but of course it's not the same as going into your wallet and seeing that I had $100 and now I only have $20 left because I bought $80 worth of items. But there is a convenience factor, and that convenience factor is valuable if we treat those debit cards maturely and responsibly and are checking regularly. Another thing is that, as I said, you only use and get those kind of debit cards from banks that do not charge a fee. There are some banks now that treat them as credit cards and they charge you a fee every time you use it. You do not want to be with that kind of setup. That's not good. And the worst scenario with the debit card is that many banks offer you a line of credit with it. This is just another seduction into borrowing, which the bank is putting into your hands, and this is really putting that debit card into credit card land, and it will be a very, very nefarious circumstance for you because you will inevitably overreach the cash that you have in your bank account and you will be borrowing, and we don't want to be borrowing, particularly for the wants category. This is what gets many, many people in trouble. In my practice and personal experience, I find the most challenging thing for Americans nowadays is to get back into the cash-only mentality. It's very important, if you are struggling with your finances, to keep control of your money. And this means, essentially, go to a cash transaction basis. It's really, really helpful to regain control of your money situation. And as we're talking about wants or the fun money, if you're spending that in cash, it really gives you that feeling of freedom. You only have the money up to the limit point, and then that's it. The cash is gone, your fun money is gone, your wants money is gone, and so now we don't go in the red. We're still in the safe situation. I've even seen a semi-healthy kind of situation where people who are recreational gamblers go to Atlantic City or Las Vegas and they have a cash fun money limit of X amount of dollars. They only will gamble with that amount of money. If they make more, they'll be very happy, but they never spend more than that cash fun money. When they're wise, they walk away with some more money in their pocket, but oftentimes they will expend all the money that they had in their little bankroll limit, but that's fine if it is reasonable and it's all within their budget of wants. It gives them the pleasure, which we're not going to evaluate what you're spending your want money on, but just that it is within the limits. The real important thing about cash is that you don't need a calculator, you don't need to keep records, there's no chance to get in trouble. And your wallet right there is your budget reminder for the wants. And it really makes you 100% certain that I have the money or I don't have the money. You can see ahead of time when to stop. And so you are in a safe scenario. So a recap on the wants is that this is your fun money that you want to go to a cash amount. And the advantages of cash in review are easy to tell how much you can spend if you have cash. No need to keep complicated spending records. No surprises at the end of the month. No damaged credit records. No billing mistakes or overcharges. No late fees or over-the-limit charges. No interest charges. No risk of going into debt. Some merchants will even give a discount if you're using cash. And the best part is that cash is accepted everywhere. So with your wants, you have set a limit of how much money you have available, and two, you use cash and then you spend it as you like it. And the final tip for the week, if you haven't updated your insurance, your home, medical, automobile insurance as your primary insurance issues in the last 2 years, now is the time to get quotes from a number of sources to see if you can lower your premiums. Your savings can be significant if you shop around and get a lot of quotes from reputable sources. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt bankruptcyadvice@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa.